Yeah, baby. It's episode 149 of Ask the Inspector on April 9th, 2024. Jeff Norman and Scott Ritter with Yelena the Magnificent backstage helping us out with the comments and so forth. And we just published a new Substack post, Sympathy for the Devil Part 2. And just minutes ago, actually. And I guess one of the things that struck me, Scott, was how you got very specific about an incident that really tugs at the heartstrings, but you also pointed out how there's many more instances like that. It's emblematic of what's been going on quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, this, just so the audience knows, I'm not the world's most religious person, but I have studied religion, which is one of the reasons why I'm not the world's most religious person. But I'm familiar with the Bible. And I'm familiar with the Quran, and I'm familiar with the Torah. I'm familiar with Talmudic studies. I'm familiar with Hadiths. I'm familiar with a whole bunch of things. And, you know, the subtitle of this article is The Amalek Effect. And that's in reference to statements made by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu regarding do not forget Amalek. Amalek are the Amalekites, a tribe that harassed the Jews, attacked the Jews and their pilgrims out of Egypt. And in the Bible, Samuel, the prophet, tells Saul to commit genocide, in short, kill them all. And Saul proceeds to almost do that. He decides that he's going to keep the king and some of his kids alive and some of the choice cows and stuff. But Samuel's not happy. He brings in Agag, the king, hacks him to death. But some of the sons get away. And this leads to many, many generations on when in the Babylonian captivity period, Esther, a Jewish lady, is wed to the Babylonian king. And she finds out that Haman, the progeny distantly of Agag, is planning to kill all the Jews. And so she turns the table on them and they end up killing Haman and all of his followers. Lots of them, like 75,000 plus. And this is celebrated by the Jewish faith every year in Purim. Purim celebrates the completion of genocide. I just want to make it clear, ladies and gentlemen, there's no debating this. Purim celebrates Esther.
Purim, let the Jew correct you if you don't mind. Purim, not Purim.
It's Purim to me, baby. No, it's I mispronounce Purim. Everything, but Purim celebrates basically the completion of genocide. So this isn't theoretical, and it's woven into the Jewish faith. And, you know, Netanyahu invokes this in charging the Israeli Defense Force to kill everybody, because that's what they were told to do. And the Israeli soldiers jump up and down and talk about their mitzvah, their truth, their search for truth includes, you know, eliminating the seed of Amalek, getting rid of everybody, doing what Esther did in Babylon, completing this. So I get into this a little bit. But the reason I bring this up about, you know, tiny little, her name, the six-year-old girl.
Oh, a Hinda or something like that? Was that
Hindra Diab, I think it is, yes. Is that in the end, I say, you know, because I talk about Samuel's command to Saul, and I go into why that isn't the word of God. The reason why this is simply for the devil is, you know, I mean, just give you a brief hint without going too much. When after Samuel died, Saul went to a witch, the witch of Endor, and had the ghost of Samuel brought up so he can consult with him. That ain't how God in heaven works. That's how Satan and hell works. So Samuel was a tool of the devil. And what he told Saul to do was not God's word. It was Samuel's word. And I bring that up because the Bible does provide some evidence of how God would proceed. Take, for instance, when Abraham meets the three travelers, one of whom is the Lord in disguise, and he's told that God plans to smite Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham turns to him and says, "You can't do that, boss. These are people down. What if I could find 50 righteous people? Would you spare them? Spare the city?" And God, if you find 50, he said, what if I find 45? And they brought it all down to What if I find 10? And God said, if you can find me 10 righteous people, I'll spare the city. That's the approach. That's the biblical approach, meaning that human life has value and that we should be looking for the righteous amongst us. And that's why I bring up Hind, and I bring up her cousin, Layla, and I bring up the family, the Hamada family. I bring up the two paramedics that went to rescue them, coordinated with the Israelis, but were assassinated as they arrived at the scene, because it was all a part of the scheme of the seed of Amalek. Everybody must be destroyed, men, women, children. There are no innocents, according to the Israelis. And this isn't hypothetical. This isn't conspiracy theory. This is the frickin' prime minister of Israel directing his soldiers to annihilate the seed of Amalek. And they're doing it. And that was just, that's just seven righteous people. And then at the end, I close with the seven additional righteous people of the World Chef's Kitchen, WCK NGO that were murdered by the Israelis. Why? Well, because the Israelis call the Gazans human animals and to be starved. You can't allow them to eat. You know, this is why they did the flour massacre. You know, when they brought in the trucks, allowed everybody to gather around and open fire on them, an ambush designed to A, kill the seed of Amalek, and B, ensure that aid agencies aren't going to deliver food, starve them to death. That's why they killed these seven aid workers. There's 14 righteous people right there, four more than God required. For all you Jews out there, and I don't mean to pick on the Jews, but hey, guys, this is your religion that's being perverted by Netanyahu. Where the hell is your voice? Why aren't you shouting out? Why do you leave it up to a goyim, a Christian? It's not my job to do this. It's your fucking job to do it. Do it. Get out there and call the goddamn prime minister of Israel to account for what he's doing in destroying your faith. Because if you don't want, and I'm one of the people who have been articulating for a long time now, that we have to differentiate between Zionists and Jews. That Zionists may be evil, but Jews aren't. But I'm telling you right now, if the Jewish faithful are saying it's okay to invoke Amalek to slaughter the Palestinians, and you're silent on this issue, then maybe the Jewish faith is the problem here. Prove me wrong. Stand up and do something. And that's why I wrote the article the way I did. I didn't want to go down this route. When I first wrote it, it was supposed to be part two. It was supposed to be derived from a conversation I had with a Jewish merchant in New York City, where we were talking, where he was basically saying the Jews are above the law. And so I was going to basically talk about how Zionism was evil. Sympathy for the Devil, part two, was going to be about the evil of Zionism. But then this whole genocide thing came up. They took it to the International Court of Justice. I said, whoa, I got to hold off and see how this plays out. And then that goddamn son of a bitch, Benjamin Netanyahu, invokes Amalek, and the frickin' Israeli troops start acting on it, and they start murdering people. There's 33,000 righteous people been murdered by the Israelis in Gaza. 33,000. 13 to 15,000 who are children. There's 1.6 million righteous people in Gaza right now, starving to death, dying of disease, being bombed on a daily basis by the Israelis. This isn't acceptable. This is unacceptable. And you have to call it out. So that's what I did through this article. And I know, thank goodness, Siri's not here, because I swore and I lost my temper, and I'm not supposed to do that. But
I won't turn you in, Scott. Hey, I want to get to the questions from the audience. But before I do, I have to ask you one question about this. You described one of the incidents, and the Israelis said it was an accident, and they fired a couple of the commanders to make it seem as though it was accidental. My question to you is, are the commanders that they fire, are they just like sacrificial lambs, or are they sort of in on it, wink, wink, we're not really firing you? I mean, what about that part of it?
Well, first of all, this wasn't an accident. I want to make it as clear as possible it wasn't an accident. I've worked with Israeli drone operators. I've worked with Israeli drone units. I'm intimately familiar with the quality of their product and how they operate. This was targeted assassination. This was targeted murder. They said it's in violation of Israeli SOPs. Hey, when the Israeli SOPs allow tanks to kill Hind Rajab, okay? If you can murder a six-year-old girl, you can blow up an aid convoy, and they've blown up aid convoys. The mistake the Israelis made here is they killed five white people or six white people. Oops, bad move, guys, because suddenly, 200 aid workers have been killed prior to this, but they were primarily brown Palestinians. Now, I know there's people out there get pissed at me. Pam, I apologize. You know, they're white people.
It's funny how you remember their names, too. Phil and Pam.
But, you know, look, the whole point is killing brown people with funny sounding Arabic names doesn't resonate here in the West. We just go, oh, that's just.
But what about my question, Scott? If I were one of those fired commanders, I wouldn't be happy about that.
You're not fucking fired, Jeff.
That's what I'm asking.
Give me a name. Give me a name. Give me a name of a fired commander.
Well, that's what I'm asking you to explain.
That's what I'm trying to explain. That this is not a mistake. This was targeted assassination. The major and the unnamed reserve colonel are going to get fucking medals for this. And they're going to be given promotions. And they're going to go away. And they're going to be like, we're heroes. You know, they didn't make a mistake. The mistake was that, you know, the mistake is the policy itself. And when you have extreme policies, you get extreme results. And the world finally woke up, not because they're killing brown people, though, because they killed six white people. And everybody went, oh, shit, we can't do that. Let's fire a major. What's his name? Give me his name. You don't have his name, do you? Give me the lieutenant colonel's name. You don't have it. They're gone. They're going to get promoted. They're going to go away. Pat on the back. Don't worry about this. Take it. Take one for the team. We're going to take care of you. They didn't. Nobody lost their job over this.
That's what I was wondering. Okay. Thank you. Calm yourself, Scott.
No. Please.
All right, let's get to the questions from our beloved audience. This is the lightning round, which we do every Tuesday, which means Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less. Please join us also on Friday night at 8 p.m. for the loquacious version, when Scott answers every question much more extensively, and I just sit here and look sexy as hell. I look sexy as hell on Tuesdays also, but it's just I kind of bask in it more on Friday nights.
Well, the wine does help.
It doesn't hurt. Jenny B. Smith from Washington. Do you know if Russia still supports communist Cuba? How is Cuba getting their funding? I believe that the Soviet era is over, but Cuba still seems to be fully communist.
Well, I mean, Russia still supports Cuba, the sovereign state of Cuba. I don't think Russia gives a damn whether or not Cuba's communist or not. They care that Cuba continues to be victims of American sanctions, that the Cubans continue to be oppressed by American policies. I don't know the level to which Russia was able to sustain Soviet-era funding. My guess is that it diminished over time, but it might be building back up. But they very much retain a strategic relationship. They're very good friends. They're very good partners in the region. So, the Russians and the Cubans are A-OK.
Next question. Well, hold on. Let me do it this way. Next question comes from Mia in Kentucky. Are you familiar with Dan Perry, author of Ask Questions Later? That's the Substack post blog, rather, that he runs. He was on Al Jazeera recently and adamantly argued that the war in Gaza is not a genocide and that people being killed doesn't equal genocide. What is your response to people who share his view? As if we don't know the answer to that question, but are you familiar with Dan Perry?
I am not, and I'm not familiar with his Ask Questions Later Substack, although I should be, since it has a similar theme to ours. We should find out what's he doing right and see if we can copy it. But
or we should file a copyright infringement lawsuit against him for stealing the Ask the.
Who came over the first, us or them? Anyways, I'm running out of time. I only have 2 minutes and 40 seconds left to answer the question. Mia, let me put it back at you this way, because I treat your question as a legitimate question. I think you have genuine intellectual curiosity. At what point in time does a genocide become a genocide? I mean, you know, at one point in time, the Nazis held, I believe it was the Swansea meeting, where they sat down and they plotted out the final solution against the Jews. Does the clock on genocide start when they make the decision, we're going to kill all the Jews? Or does it stop when it's over and you count up the bodies and go, this qualifies as a genocide? I mean, where in the sliding bar does it go, from the decision to the end or somewhere in between? And if it's somewhere in between, if we're counting bodies, as Mr. Perry suggests is the way to do it. I mean, so if I want to kill all the Jews, but I've only killed 100,000 so far, is it genocide? Because according to Dan Perry, there's 5.5 5.5 million Jews, or 5.9 million Jews left to kill. So I keep going, and now I've killed a million. Is that a genocide? No, I still got 5 million left to kill. It ain't quite a genocide yet, pal. So where does it begin? This is where I would take umbrage at Mr. Perry. It's not about the numbers. It's about the intent. And that's what the International Court of Justice said. If you read all of their reasoning, it's the intent behind the actions of the Israelis. It's the intent, the Amalek intent to, come on, Amalek is the manifestation of genocide, biblical manifestation brought to life today by the prime minister directing his soldiers to wipe out the seed of Amalek. I would say that's genocidal intent. And do we have to wait for them to actually kill all the Palestinians before we call it genocide? Or do we say, hey, you have intent and you're acting it out. You've given instructions and those instructions are being acted out. How many Hinra jobs have to die? How many six-year-old girls have to die in the back of a car asking for help as the Israelis lure in the paramedics to murder them using her as bait and then they kill her too? And the answer should be none. One is too many. So I think Mr. Perry's wrong. I think the fact is the Israelis have announced a policy. They've articulated what they want, and they've given orders. Those orders are being carried out, and we don't need to wait for all 1.6 million Palestinians to die before we call this a genocide.
All right. We maybe just gave Mr. Perry some unwanted publicity, but they say all publicity is good, so maybe he'll be happy. Let's take a phone call, Scott. Hey there, you're on with our favorite weapons inspector on the lightning round. What's your question?
Hello?
What's your question?
Oh, good afternoon. My question for Scott today is, I want Scott's opinion on something that happened in 1999. During the bombing of Yugoslavia, I mean, Russia was still weak, but they did a move when they sent their soldier into Kosovo. Well, why didn't NATO wipe their troops out of Kosovo during that time while they were still weak? Why do you think that is, Scott?
Well, you're talking about Pristina Airfield. You're talking about the Russian paratroopers who went in and took over Pristina to prevent NATO from coming in and taking over Pristina. Theoretically, the numbers of Russian troops involved was minimal. And the NATO had sufficient force. And indeed, General Clark ordered the British general commander on the scene to go in and resolve this issue, to take the Russians out. But that general wisely backed off. You know, the perception of Russian weak, how weak do you need to be when you got thermonuclear weapons? The answer is you ain't weak. Yeah, Russia couldn't stand, you know, you're not going to go to nuclear war all the time. Russia had a doctrine, but Russia wasn't going to stand by and let their paratroopers get wiped out by NATO. And NATO knew that. They didn't want to start a sequence of events. And the other thing is that NATO was sort of in the wrong here. They knew it. NATO was struggling internally with what they were doing in Kosovo in this intervention. So, you know, you weren't coming in on your strongest foot. And, the question is, how would the Russians react? Is it really a gamble you want to take over some minuscule little airfield in the middle of a country that has no meaning whatsoever? Kosovo has no meaning whatsoever. None. You know, a little geopolitical thing, but, you know, come on. It's important to the Serbs. It's important to the Kosovo, but in terms of what makes the world go round, it doesn't. So you really want to risk Third World War over that? And the answer is no. So the British general made the right decision not to confront them. I mean, you want to be a tough guy and take on the Russians? Go at it. First of all, the Russians would have fought. They would have fought hard. They would have given a good accounting of themselves. It wouldn't have been easy, but they would have lost in the end because it was an unsustainable position. But I mean, how tough are you for that? How tough can you be to do that? This wasn't about being a tough guy. It was about doing the right thing. The Russians made a bold move. In the end, it was a futile move because all it did is forestall the eventual, K4 takeover of Kosovo. But, nobody in the West in their right mind would have gone to war over that to take on the Russians over an airfield in Pristina.
All right, I started the clock very late on that, but you saved me, Scott, by keeping it brief anyway. You are the master of breviloquence. Here now, here now is a voicemail message, and I'm not positive, but I think this is our friend Todd in New Orleans. I believe I recognize his voice.
Hey, Scott. Hey, Jeff. Does Putin have a genuine desire to reobtain the Balkans and or any other country outside the Ukraine?
No. No, he doesn't want to. The Russian Federation. Let's stop talking about Putin and start talking about the Russian Federation. The Russian Federation has no designs on recreating the Warsaw Pact or anything of that nature. Would Russia like it that if Europe was on good terms with them? Absolutely. But Russia's not looking to send their troops over and reestablish bases and anything like that. They'd love to be on sound political, diplomatic relations. They'd love to have sound economic interaction, but they're not looking to recreate the Cold War. I did have an interesting interview today with Vladimir Olenik. He's a Ukrainian politician on the Scott Ritter Show, and that'll be streamed on Wednesday night. And he said something that's pretty newsworthy. He basically said that the path to peace is going to be through the creation of a Ukrainian, Belarus, Russian union, that in order for Ukraine to exist as a nation state, it can only exist as part of this union, because only through this union can Russia guarantee that NATO and the European Union won't again try to come in and change governments and move this. So that's the future of Ukraine. But that's as far as they go. They're not talking about anything other than that. Remember, this union wouldn't have happened if it weren't for the expansion of NATO. The Russians are very much interested in creating a political economic union with post-war Ukraine and Belarus. And, some people say, well, that's recreating the Soviet Union. In many ways, it is, because of the economic stability and political stability that was engendered by that. But if you think about how Ukraine's going to rebuild itself, understand this: the European Union economic model does not have Ukraine developing itself as an independent agricultural industrial power. It has Ukraine being a consumer nation, eating the products produced by the European Union. Under the Russian Union model, Ukraine will become an independent, sovereign producer of meaningful agronomy, agricultural goods, and a major industrial power that will be thoroughly integrated, not only with Russia and Belarus, but the BRICS nations and the Shanghai Cooperation, the European or the Eurasian Economic Union. It'd be the best thing could ever happen to Ukraine. Hell, a lot better than what's going on right now.
All right. Todd, proving that folks in New Orleans care more than just about music and throwing beads and partying. A real keen interest in geopolitics.
But what about crawfish?
Well, that's important. Oh, I screwed up. I thought of you the other day. Remember I told you that the Azalea Festival here in Wilmington is like Mardi Gras?
Yeah.
And then you said, is it like, the throwing beads thing? So I'm walking down the street and these like, I don't know if they were transvestites or so, it was hard to tell, but people that were sort of spoofing the bead thing. And I took out my phone to record it, but I screwed it up. I didn't hit the record button. So I don't know. I don't even know why I'm mentioning it. Let's move on. Lynn in Germany. German reporters are already mentioning that the attack on the NPP, the nuclear power plant, could have been a false flag operation by the Russian military forces. Of course, it's always their fault, or Trump's. Like they would prepare to go there. Sarcasm. Wouldn't a bigger attack, even a nuclear catastrophe caused by the NPP, blamed on Russia, open the door to an openly declared war of NATO against Russia?
No, no, and more no. Why? Because a NATO war against Russia is a nuclear war, and that would be the end of NATO. And NATO knows this, so they're not going to sit there and do something like this. This isn't about Europe wanting to. This is Ukrainian insanity. The Ukrainians right now are in a very desperate situation, and they're collapsing on all fronts, and they're desperately pulling at any string they can get to try and get Europe to intervene. So the Ukrainian mindset, which is the mindset of crazy people, is if we attack the nuclear power plant and at least create the perception that there could be a catastrophe, that the West will have to intervene to prevent that catastrophe. And that's what they're doing. Russia's not playing that game. You don't see the Russians, you know, doing anything other than going, that was pretty stupid. But Russia's not going to allow international peacekeepers on the ground. They're not going to allow NATO to step one foot into Ukraine. All Russia's going to do is destroy Ukraine, which is they're doing right now. So no, this isn't, I mean, I understand the thinking behind it, but this isn't, you know, German newspapers don't report accurately anyway. They're a bunch of propagandists who report primarily from the Ukrainian side. But no, the German government isn't sitting there going, let's create a nuclear catastrophe in Zaporizhia so we can deploy our 3.6 fat German soldiers there. Remember, Germany just committed to put a brigade into Lithuania. That's going to max out their military capacity for the next couple of years. They got nothing left to send anywhere. So, no.
Valentina, Apache Junction, Arizona. Scott, can Gaza ever recover? My heart is broken.
Well, Valentina, my heart's broken too. I mean, first of all, in what way? Can you ever recover from the death of Hind Rajab? No. I mean, that'll scar me for life. Listening to her on the phone with the Palestinian Red Crescent Society lady who was trying to comfort her, and listening to a six-year-old girl talk about tanks approaching and how scared she is, please come and take, that scarred me for life. I hope it scarred everybody who listened to that for life. Listening to 15-year-old Leyland talking about the tanks coming in, listening to the machine gun fire live on the phone as it rips through her body and kills her, scarred me for life. So we will never emotionally recover from this, nor should we ever emotionally recover from this. The crimes against humanity, when I say humanity, I mean everybody, all of us. It's a crime against us that are taking place on a daily basis by the Israelis in Gaza, should scar everybody for life. The physical reconstitution of Gaza is a distinct possibility. It is going to require global assistance. This is the global crime that's taking place right now. Even though Israel's perpetrating it, the world has in large ways facilitated this crime. So the world must pay the price of the rehabilitation of Gaza. And it's going to be difficult. There's unexploded ordnance. You just can't come in there and scrape away the bad stuff, put up new stuff. You're going to have to go in there and account for every bomb, make sure they're all dug up. You don't want to have a situation where you build a building, find out there's a 2,000-pound bomb. Yeah, I saw that image too. I mean, all these images coming out of Gaza just got you. So, you know, but there's money out there. I have to say that the Arab world is going to have to step up, because the Arab world has spent so much time turning their backs on the plight of the Palestinians that they have a moral responsibility to step and do the right thing by the people of Palestine, by putting the money up front for this rehabilitation. But China, I'm sure, will help. You know, Europe should help. I think there's going to be a lot of nations, once this thing is resolved, lining up to provide the assistance necessary to turn Palestine from a concentration camp where refugees lived into a homeland where citizens live.
Now comes a question from a Swede in Sweden. And when you think about it, that makes perfect sense. What type of weapons would the U.S. bring to Sweden when the DCA is ratified? Could it include classified weapons, unknown in scope and effect? Or are they only looking to store traditional, which is to say old weapons?
Well, the DCA, I assume, is the formal... I mean, I'd have to Google. Maybe
Elena
can Google DCA real quick so I know. I think I know what it is, but I don't want to put a term to it until I know exactly what the three letters stand for. But I think it's basically the formal agreement between CETA and NATO for military sharing, etc. Look, Sweden's a NATO nation now. And as a NATO nation, Sweden can opt to become part of the nuclear club. And what I mean by that is they won't have their own nuclear weapons because they're not allowed to, but they can become part of the NATO nuclear deterrence, where nuclear weapons are stored on Swedish soil and made available to specially equipped and trained Swedish Air Force units to be employed in case of a general war between Russia and NATO. So that is a distinct possibility. There are no other really classified weapon systems. You know, we don't have chemical weapons or biological weapons programs anymore, knock on wood. And in terms of, you know, other systems, you know, they're not classified. I mean, you know, if we were to develop an operational intermediate nuclear capable hypersonic missile, like we were thinking about at one point in time, you know, Sweden could become a place where these weapons would be deployed, but it wouldn't be done in secret. The base would have to be built, the deployment would be known, et cetera. So I think the only thing that would be secret would be the exact location of a nuclear, you know, storage facility. But for Sweden to become part of this nuclear club, there has to be meetings in NATO. They have to consider this. People have to vote on this. And you're not going to do that in secret. So I don't think there's going to be any secret, you know, weapons annex. There's always classified annex about the specificity of certain things. You don't want to give away operational planning, but not about, you know, top secret hush-hush weapon systems.
All right, Scott, I think our audience has been increasing in Ireland lately. I don't know if you've noticed that. Here's a voicemail message from a gentleman who calls himself Kev O'Fuelan in Ireland.
Scotty boy, how are you? Jeff, hello to Kev O'Fuelan here from Ireland. I just want to see if Scott could elaborate on Israel's current position in relation to the orders and mandates and instructions from the likes of the ICJ, the UN Security Council, etc. Kind of elaborate on if Israel is actually in violation of international law in relation to these instructions from these entities, and if they are, in what exact way are they in violation? Love the show. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Kevin. From Kevin O what?
O'Fuelan.
O'Fuelan.
Yeah, well, he's... I'm not sure if this is just his email spelling or what. O'Fuelan. O'Fuelan.
That's not a traditional Irish spelling of a last name, but we'll
hold
go.
On. Let's hear how he says it. It was right at the beginning. We won't have to listen to much of it.
Scotty boy, how are you? Jeff, hello to Kev O'Fuelan here from Ireland.
O'Fuelan. Okay. Well, first of all, I love the accent. I wish I was good enough to be able to say... Well, let's get a little bit of a Galway accent there. Oh, he's a Dubliner from way back, or, you know, maybe County Cork. I don't know, but it's a wonderful accent. So I'm on board there. Kevin, have you ever seen that movie? It's one of my favorite movies. It's a wonderful trilogy, The Guardians of the Galaxy. I love that movie. And there's a scene early on when they're all captured, you know, my favorite guy, Space Lord, and then the raccoon, and then the other people they're capturing, they're up there in the lineup while the guy is talking about them, and you see, you know, he's doing this until the middle finger shows up. That's the Israeli approach to the International Court of Justice. They don't give a fuck, and they're not doing a goddamn thing about it. They don't recognize the legitimacy of the court. They don't recognize the legitimacy of the action. They're taking no measures whatsoever to address any of the things that put out. They are 100% in violation of international law. And I'm surprised that more nations aren't stepping up and saying, okay, we, you know, since the way the thing's done, the Security Council isn't going to take action on it. Why don't we as individual nations start taking? I think Ireland started talking about, you know, sanctioning and things of that nature. I wish more nations would line up against it and maybe start recognizing a Palestinian state, et cetera. But Israel doesn't care about the International Court of Justice at all, zero, nothing. And they're telling them to pound sand. Now, indirectly, Israel's being pressured by the United States to try and do things like allow humanitarian goods in. But anything Israel does isn't because the International Court of Justice has said they have to do it. It's because the United States is putting pressure on them to do it. That's a different kind of pressure. One is the pressure that you get when you're dependent upon somebody. The other one is the pressure you get when you're a moral nation who believes in the rule of law. Israel's an immoral nation that has no understanding or belief or adherence to the rule of law. They're just being pressured by generally the people who are normally their facilitators, the United States.
Zay in Germany, what does the recent withdrawal of the IDF from Gaza actually mean?
Well, first of all, let's just predicate this by saying that Israel got the living shit kicked out of it by Hamas. Now, people go, how do you say that? Because they haven't won yet. They said they're going to destroy Hamas. They haven't. And the other thing is that Israel's under looming threat of attack by Iran. And if Iran attacks Israel proper, as Iran says they will, then Israel will retaliate against Iran, and that will lead to Hezbollah retaliating. Now we have a general war with Hezbollah and Iran. What Israel doesn't want to do is have all of its forces tied down in Gaza. So what they've done is they've done a strategic withdrawal from Gaza that could instantly turn into a major assault against Rafah anytime they want. So Netanyahu said, I plan on attacking Rafah. I've set the date and all that stuff. Maybe, but they have to pull these units out to get them rested, refitted, re-equipped. Plus, they have to have them available in case of a broader war with Hezbollah. The last 2 years running, Israel has done major military exercises, which they talked about a stress test. What happens if everything goes bad at once? Sort of like what's happening right now, except when they planned it, Operation Chariot of Fire last year, they never planned on Gaza blowing up. They always just assumed that Hamas could be contained, that you just... there'd be small terrorist actions, but there wouldn't be anything big. And Israel had no intention of going into Gaza to begin with. You get some rockets fired, Iron Dome takes up, terrorist action, but you contain it. No one in Israel in these war games ever thought that 60% of the Israeli army would be tied down in Gaza in a losing fight when the big one happens with Hezbollah and Iran. And so they don't have a war plan that says 60% in Gaza and then everybody else has to make do. Their war plan says we got to have everybody up here in the north dealing with Hezbollah. And so what they've done is they've withdrawn and they've pre-positioned their troops up north to deal with Hezbollah in case of the big one. But now, if the Iranian retaliation is such that it doesn't require an Israeli retaliation that leads to a general war, then these troops, which aren't going to be sent to the front lines, they're sent in the back where they'll be prepared as reserves if needed. These troops can then, once they've rested and everything, be redirected back and back into Rafah to finish the mission. So that's my understanding of what's going on with the Israeli military movements at the moment.
Maria in Romania asks, now that Israel has killed foreign workers and also bombed a consulate, both indisputably war crimes, why isn't any country, not even China or Russia at least, opening the dialogue on economic sanctions on Israel in the United Nations Security Council?
Well, one, I think they tried to go to the Security Council to have a discussion about the attack on the consulate, and the president of the Security Council, under pressure from the United States, wouldn't even allow that discussion to be tabled. You know, it's a question of, again, I can't answer. I would just imagine that if I'm the Russians and the Chinese, you know what the outcome is going to be. It's going to be a veto from the United States and probably from, the France and England. So it won't happen. So do you really want to, at this point in time, put all your money on that, going through a process that you know what the outcome is going to be? Or are the Chinese going to be instead on the phone right now talking to Iran, talking to the United States, and trying to come up with a situation that avoids escalation that could lead to general war? I hope everybody understands that, for all the people out there saying, oh, come on, Iran, hit Israel, baby, hit them. Because you know that Israel's going to hit back. And for all those pro-Israeli people, let's time we took out Iran. You guys are dumber than dirt. Notice I modified my language, Jeff.
Very good.
The other term was reserved for you almost exclusively. But now...
Siri, if you're watching the recording, hi.
But
well behaved.
I'm working on it, maybe. But the point is, minute 33. Okay. If there's a war between Iran and Israel, this war will blow over into Iran in the region. American bases will be hit. And if Iran's oil infrastructure is struck, Iran will ensure that nobody in the region produces oil. And now we're looking at a global economic catastrophe. The Houthi will not only ensure that nothing passes through the Bab el-Mandeb Straits, but Iran will likewise close the Strait of Hormuz, and it will be a complete economic collapse. Do you want that for all you brave, heroic people sitting behind desks, pounding on keyboards, bomb, bomb, bomb. Do you really want that? Because you'll lose your job. You'll lose everything. You won't be able to drive your cars because you can't afford gas. That's what's going to happen if there's this war. So excuse the Chinese and the Russians for a moment, both of whom are depending upon their, you know, economic trajectory being in a positive direction. If they want to spend most of their time on the phone saying, hey, how do we prevent this thing from escalating out of control? And less time saying, let's put everything into pursuing a futile resolution at the Security Council that we know the United States will veto. So that's what I think is going on here.
All right, Scott, I guess it was inevitable. Our friend from New York, who heretofore has left nothing but flawless voicemail messages in his endearing New York accent, has finally left a voicemail message that I would describe with all due respect as imperfect.
Good afternoon, Scott and Jeff. I made a mistake. I don't know if my last recording went, if I sent it or not. But the question is simply this. I'm at the conclusion that Jeff is right about Twitter. It is a twisted place. All right, that out of the way. The question is this, to Scott. I'm sitting in the union hall with a bunch of guys, and we want to know what we have to do, okay? Because we're going down to the Francis, to the bridge that collapsed, and we're gonna, you know, make America great again. But who the hell is behind us? Is Trump behind us? Because the steel we get comes from China, and it's crap, and it doesn't work. Okay, so when is America really gonna be great again? When we can produce, okay, men like myself, and steel that's made here that lasts for hundreds of years, like the Brooklyn Bridge. When's that going to take place, Scott? When are the American people going to finally hit the mattresses and say enough is enough? Thank you.
I love this guy and his references to the mattresses. All right. Is his name John, right, John?
No, I don't think he ever gave us his name. Hey, if you're listening, friend in New York, maybe the time has come to give us at least
or just give us a name. You can go under, because you're probably mafia, so you don't want to give us your real name. But, you know, give something that we can put you. But the guy with the great Long Island accent, the union worker, the steel worker. And here's the key. And now I'm going to get serious. I'm not a steel worker. And, you know, I have limited knowledge of steel, but I have heard that some of the steel that we buy from overseas isn't to the standard that maybe we used to produce. And I would imagine that if we're going, first of all, God bless you and your fellow workers for going down to Baltimore and helping with this horrific situation with the Francis Scott Key Bridge, and stay safe, because it's not going to be easy work. It's going to be very difficult work. And so to you and all your other guys, let me put it this way. If you ever identify yourself and you want to ever identify your union hall, I can promise you this. As long as you guys promise not to cut me up into little pieces and throw me in the ocean, I'll come down and drink beer with you anytime. And have a kind of, we'll just do it as man to man in a union hall. Nobody has to know about it. No cameras coming in. We just do it. So send Jeff a little message if you ever want to make that happen. And I promise you I'll be there, because you guys are the salt of the earth. You are what makes America great. Not again, but always. But you bring up an important point. What can you do? Well, I would imagine that once you cut up all the beams and you drag it away, if they're going to use you to reconstruct the bridge, that you insist on standards being met, because ain't nothing going to happen without you. Is there really another iron workers union out there? I don't think so. Or steel workers union? I don't think so. So if you guys come in and say, we refuse to build this bridge without made in America steel that's made to the standard that we insist it be for safety reasons. Let's make America great again. Let's build a Brooklyn Bridge. Let's build a bridge that can last. Let's build a bridge that we're proud of. Let's build a bridge that says made in the USA from top to bottom. You can make that happen by simply saying we're not going to accept inferior products. If you get enough of you guys out there to say that, and you stand that, the American people will back you 100%. You stand that on your picket line and say, no, no bridge built unless it says made in America. I want it made in America. I want American steel. and get the American government to invest in American steel plants to produce the steel that's needed to put the Francis Scott Key Bridge back up. And not just that, but all the other crumbling infrastructure out there, all these politicians that say, we believe in America, going to get whipped real soon. So now you know my solution. And there's the answer. We can talk about it in the beer hall. Call me.
Okay. Oh, wrong. I'm just hitting everything here. You know, I said his question was imperfect because he said that I said something or other was twisted.
I didn't understand that part either, but that's okay.
Yeah. 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 I love this guy too. I think we should make him a regular part of the show. Next question comes from Dave in Olympia, Washington. Iran and their allies seem to be bending over backwards to not let Israel provoke them into a major conflict, but Israel seems to be completely unhinged in their provocations. Are we facing anything similar to the buildup to World War I, where nobody wants a major conflict, but dominoes will fall and one will erupt?
Yeah, I mean, good question, Dave. I've brought up Barbara Tuchman's book, The Guns of August, before. That's a wonderful book she wrote about the lead up to World War I. She talks about the summer of 2014 and how basically everybody's just nonchalantly going, it's okay. Nobody wants this war. So they're just posturing and, you know, maneuvering and, you know, things. And next thing you know, boom, we're at war. So I think that's where we're at right now. I mean, I go back to Maria from Romania's question. If, just so everybody knows, I think tomorrow is Eid al-Fitr, the end of the month of Ramadan, a holy month for the Islamic world. And I've always postulated, again, I can't speak on behalf of the Islamic Republic of Iran, but I've postulated that they would not want to start a major war with Israel during the month of Ramadan, that they would wait until after after Eid and then move. So I'm thinking Thursday, Friday this week could be very critical days, days where, you know, Iran makes a decision, not only, you know, to retaliate, but how, in what manner. And the decision they make right now is key to then what Israel does after that. Will Israel simply absorb this attack? Will Israel take the attack and then hit with a lesser retaliation just to say, okay, we hit you, but now, and then Iran goes, all right, but then they get back down to a sense of normalcy, or Iran punches, Israel punches back, and next thing you know, you got a big war, and the whole world's going, we didn't want this. Because trust me, nobody wants us. Even all those anti-Iranian Jews and the Zionists in Israel, they don't want this. They may think they want it, but I think they're learning the hard way that they don't, because the Houthi blockade of the port of Eilat is destroying their economy. I mean, Israel is losing the ability to sustain itself as a modern nation state. And they're waking up going, this is bad news for the economy. I'm here to tell you right now, if you have a general war with Iran, your economy's gone forever. So I think it's time for the adults to step up and start telling people, no, this isn't going to happen. I mean, Iran made a move. They said, give us a ceasefire that brings an end to this war, and we'll not strike Israel. But Israel won't play that game. Israel refuses. So, yeah, I think we're looking at a Guns of August scenario, and we may wake up maybe as soon as Saturday and find ourselves in a global conflict that is going to destroy our respective economies.
Jasmine in the United States of America. The U.S. troops have been ordered to leave Niger. What will happen next, in your opinion? Will the United States withdraw?
Yes, we have a base, base 201, I think it is. We had two bases, base 101, which is outside the Niger capital, and base 201, which is off in the middle of the desert, where we have, it's primarily a drone base. We had a squadron of Reaper drones, MQ-9s, primarily unarmed, but we had the ability to have armed drones operating there. And the drone base was supposed to be part of this overall U.S.-French European Union approach to saving West Africa from the forces of terrorism. But the problem is the French were identified as the terrorists by the sovereign states of Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, and now Senegal has joined too, and the French have been kicked out. The Russians have been brought in. And our drones now have no friends to play with. And the Niger government basically said, you got to go too. And so I think right now, you know, we will ultimately go. I think we'll try and make it in a way that doesn't appear that we're leaving with our tail between our legs. We're hopefully, from an American perspective, find an alternative base in the region that we can relocate these assets of the mission, or whatever it was, the counterterrorism mission, could be continued maybe in Nigeria. But no, our presence in Niger is done. We're not operating right now. We're not allowed to operate. And eventually we're going to have to go.
Next question comes from Zach in Utah. Can you explain why North Korea uses solid fuel propellant in its missiles and rockets instead of liquid fuel? What are the pros and cons?
Yeah. Liquid fuel has a slower burn rate. It can produce a lot of thrust, but it's a slower kind of thrust, slow burning thrust. So your missile's not going to be going Mach 5. It's going to be a large takeoff slow and then make its way to the top. The other thing is you can do liquid fuel one of two ways. You can preload the fuel in the oxidizer. The way the liquid fuel engine works is you have your fuel, your oxidizer, and then they get mixed into a combustion chamber. And when they mix, they burn, and then that creates the fuel, or that creates the thrust in there. Normally, these are very corrosive fuels, especially the oxidizer if you're using IRFNA, inhibited red nitric fuming acid. And if you, once you load it in, immediately the corrosion process starts. And the basic, the design of the missile is you can have a fueled missile for a certain period of time before you have to defuel it and rehab the whole missile, which is a pain in the neck. So your liquid missiles are normally stored unfueled, which means if you're going to launch them, you have to fuel them up. That takes time, and it creates a footprint that's visible from above. So intelligence people like me can go, oh, they're fueling up the liquid missiles, which means if you're fueling them up, you're not putting them in for storage, you're going to use them. So now we preempt, we strike, etc. The other way to do it is the way the Soviets did it, is they have fuel that is stored. They designed the missile that the fuel is in the rocket. It's treated as a loaded round of ammunition. If you go to the SS-11, I believe, maybe the SS-17, these were considered to be pre-fueled missiles in their silos, which means they can respond quicker. But there's still a different kind of burn. You're not going to get a hypersonic liquid-fueled engine unless you attach a ramjet to it later on. But solid fuel is instant. It's there long-term. Once you produce it, that missile can be fired at any time. It doesn't need to be pre-fueled, etc. The other thing is the solid fuel can burn with a lot more energy quickly. So when you launch it, it's literally, if you watch something, it's gone. You ain't gonna get a liquid missile doing that. This thing is gone. And so it has greater response time and greater performance. And so solid fuel is, but the technology to create solid fuel is also more demanding than the technology to create a liquid fuel. And so not every nation can master that technology.
It almost seems as if that question was in your wheelhouse.
I know something about it. I didn't. There was there was a time, because I just want to remind all people that I started as a Marine Corps intelligence officer. My thing was putting artillery shells on target and using all the Marine Corps tools to do that. So I was very good at a very small little slice of things. And then they sent me to Russia to do inspections of missiles I knew nothing about. So I had to learn about them very quickly. And I was a good student. I attended the solid rocket motor production course that was run by Magna, by the Hercules Corporation in Magna, Utah. Then I went to Hill Air Force Base and studied the missile rehabilitation. And then as a weapons inspector in Iraq, I always surrounded myself with the smartest people in the world, real rocket scientists. And they taught me everything. We had a little thing where we'd start a discussion with the Iraqis, and I couldn't give away that I was dumber than dirt, because I really was. So I let my guys run it. But eventually, my authority diminishes if they're answering all the questions. So I would stop and get a gist of where we're going. Then I'd say, time out, call my team in, and say, okay, we're getting ready to talk about trajectories and warhead separation. Give me something smart to say. And I remember the one guy goes, all right, what you want to talk about is the Delta V. Apparently it's something about the ballistic trajectory at the top. Blah, blah, blah. And I said, give me some words. Boom, 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 boom. Okay, now when they start saying something and it's time for me to transition the talk to Delta V, I need you to give me a signal. And it was going to be the nose. So I was sitting there and they're actually talking. And I hear that. I go, stop right now. This is bullshit. What we got to be talking about right now is the Delta V of this thing. And if we're not talking about Delta V, you're fucking lying to me. This is goddamn travesty. Take it over. And then my guy would step in. The director's like, holy shit, he knows something about ballistic missiles. I don't know about ballistic missiles, but I learned a lot. So anyways, that's where we're at. I just knocked down my Mont Blanc plane. By
you got into that one. Now it is your bailiwick even. Would you go so far as to call it your bailiwick?
I'm good at it. I'm not an expert because I'm not a scientist. If you ever ask me to sit down and do formulas and stuff like that, ain't going to happen. But I can talk in very specific generalities about a broad range of subjects related to ballistic missiles.
All right. Yelena, instead of teasing this guy and keeping his question up there, why don't we actually address it? Can you get that question back where he said, Citizen Jeff, can you get Scott to answer this question? There you go. I still hope you would have a chance to ask about the connection between the Crocus terrorist attack and Burisma, the one linked to Biden, recently declared by Russian authorities. The claim is the attack was funded by Burisma.
No, I mean, I saw that. I saw the statement. I don't have the underlying evidence. I mean, right now, all I have to go off is the statement by Russian authorities. I would imagine that that they wouldn't commit to something like that unless what I would say is this, that I think that they, Scott ain't no chemist. You're damn right. I'm not a chemist. I can't read the comments. Black him out.
He ain't no rabbi either if he says the holiday is Purim.
Purim. Well, thank you for correcting me. You know, when I arrived in I think the first time I arrived in Israel, it was the Purim holiday or something like that. And I may have mispronounced it then too. That's okay. They liked me.
It is okay.
Delta is change. V is velocity. Rocket physics. We learned from gravitational escape. Thank you. Delta V is change in velocity. Thank you. I remember that now. This was a long time ago when I pulled that Delta V scam. I think 1994.
Now you're reading comments that aren't even flashed on the screen.
Okay. Back to this one. Burisma. There's Maverick is also upset. But Burisma is an entity. It's a shell. We know that. It's not they're an energy holding company, and they've been involved in a whole bunch of corrupt schemes. And I think there's no doubt in my mind that if I were the Ukrainian intelligence looking for money to fund this that didn't come from the federal budget, I would go to an entity like Burisma and take money from them. Now, so I believe that happened. What I can't say is that because Burisma had this relationship with Hunter Biden and, you know, with Joe Biden, that Joe Biden is directing it. I can't go there. But I am comfortable enough to say that if the Russians are saying that Burisma was funding, they have evidence to point to Burisma's funding.
Oh, you're done. Okay. Let's go to the next question. Hang on a second here. Bulldog in Quebec, we often hear U.S. officials claim to be protecting their sources when they refuse to elaborate on or provide proof of their claims, as heard again regarding the warning given to Russia before the Crocus attack. Does this excuse carry any weight, or is it employed as a dodge to avoid inquiry?
Normally, if you're a good intelligence officer, and I used to be a good intelligence officer, if you have a really sensitive source, let's say I listened to a conversation and the conversation was very specific. I couldn't talk about the details of that conversation because the moment I did, the people who were participants in that conversation would know that they were being listened to. And that would be the last time that I would be able to intercept whatever means I was using to, you know, whatever means they were talking about. So what I would do then is pull back and say, okay, let's break this piece of information into its component parts. And then you sit there and say, okay, you know, do we have anything out there that about this or about that or about this? And you go, yeah, we got this report here. It's based upon commercial documents that we got. It's not very sensitive, confidential. I go, okay, and what is that? That's here. Okay, what do we got here? And I put enough information together that I don't have to say what was in the conversation. I can put a package together that says, hey, Russia, we're concerned about something. look, we got this commercial documentation here that talks about this. We got this over here that talks about this. We got this. And we think something's happening. I don't have to be specific because it'd be too specific. You sort of give away the phone call. But I can at least point the Russians in the right direction so that they can figure it out. That's it. And that, you know, and if you wanted to say, well, I'm protecting my sources and methods, then you're going to, that's one way to talk, but at least you got to put something on the table. The moment you say, don't use the whip, that would be very mean, Matt. The moment you say, I'm protecting my sources and methods, therefore I'm not going to talk about it, it means you're bullshitting them, because that's not how professionals work. Professionals work by always being able to put something on the table. If you're hiding behind the screen of sources and methods, it means that you're making shit up. Excuse my language. That's that. Because all if right. if the source was so sensitive you couldn't talk about it, why are you talking about it? There's my thing. I always, you know, we found this out. Oh, okay, so you're talking about it. Tell me how you find it out. I can't tell you. It's too sensitive. Then why the fuck are you talking about it? Don't talk about it. If it's that goddamn secret, keep your lips sealed. Don't talk about it, especially in America, because you know what happens in America? When you don't talk about it, somebody talks about it to the Washington Times, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and then we get to read about it on the front page, top secret information that people like me used to protect with my lives, and now it's out for political reasons. So if you can't talk about it with some sort of sourcing, don't talk about it.
Okay, this is from Matt.
Reclaiming my time, sir. Reclaiming my time.
It might be a little too loud. Sorry about that. All right, that'll do it for this week's edition of Ask the Inspector, the lightning round. We do it every Tuesday for an hour, starting at 3 p.m. Eastern time. Please join us Friday night for the loquacious version, which commences at 8 p.m. Eastern time. Two glorious hours of Scott Ritter answering questions very extensively from you, our beloved audience. And I want to remind you to go to scottritterextra.com to read the latest post from Scott. And while you're there, if you haven't already, and if you haven't, why the H-E double hockey sticks haven't you yet subscribed?
Jeff, this is a family show. You can't use language like that. Siri well, will be upset.
Siri should applaud me for saying it that way. H-E double hockey sticks. Okay. Sympathy for the Devil Part 2 at scottritterextra.com. Thanks also to Yelena, who's backstage, and she's right there modeling the T-shirt, which is for sale at scottrittermerch.com. Look at her with no smile. Now look at her with the smile. The two sides of Yelena.
She's been westernized in the second photograph.
That's right. You can also buy an autographed copy of Scott's most recent book, Disarmament in the Time of Perestroika, also at scottrittermerch.com.
Can I say something about the book real quick?
Okay, why not?
No, just an interesting, I do read reviews, you know, just because it's good to get feedback. But it was funny, somebody wrote a review and it began, I forget where I read this in a comment someplace, but they said, you know, when I got the book, you know, the title is horrible, horrible title. I thought it was a great title, but horrible title because it suggests the boring book. You know, Disarmament, Time of Perestroika. Then they said it was like a reading a spy novel, da 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 da, because it sort of is. But my point is, guys, work past the title. Get the book and read it. Try it. You'll like it.
I agree with both of those points. I don't know if I would say it's a horrible title, but it is difficult to say and difficult to remember. You got disarmament, which is a difficult word, and also perestroika, both in the title. Well, I guess you know what words we're talking about.
They're there in red, big letters.
Yeah, right. Okay. Anyway, you can get it at scottrittermerch.com, also the Scott Ritter Challenge coin. So we appreciate you supporting us, and that's a good way to support us. Thank you, Yelena, for your great work backstage. Thanks to our beloved audience. And most of all, thanks to our favorite weapons inspector, Scott Ritter, William Ritter Jr., as he is known in official circles. Join us Friday night at 8 p.m. That's it, everybody. Take care. Bye-bye. Toodles.